This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
In 1974, Deborah Levy's family was exiled from South Africa to northwest London. In her funny and moving essay, Things I Don't Want to Know, published this year by Notting Hill Editions, Levy describes with affectionate and ironic hindsight her younger self, sitting in a greasy spoon by the bus station in West Finchley and writing on paper napkins. She was 15. I had a vague idea this was how writers were supposed to behave, because I had read books about poets and philosophers drinking espresso in French cafes while they wrote about how unhappy they were. Sojourns in the cafe were infrequent, because Deborah had to do housework at home. One Saturday job involved scrubbing out the family's washing machine. The existential writers who I thought might give me some clues, I always got the letters of Jean-Paul Sartre's last name mixed up so it came out as Jean-Paul Stare, probably didn't have to clean ovens with evil Brillo pads, which had been designed to waste the lives of girls and women. When I was 15, in 1964, I lived near West Finchley, in Edgware. My Saturday jobs included having to polish the parquet floor, change the sheets on our beds, make the tea. My father and brother did no housework. My French mother worked full-time as a teacher, yet remained responsible for all domestic chores. She'd been a student at the Sorbonne in the 30s, told us about dancing all night, then breakfasting at Les Halles on onion soup. I fantasised she'd tangled with Sartre. Unlikely. Mum remained a staunch Catholic, suspicious of philosophy, a committed conservative. Nonetheless, thanks to her example of voracious reading whenever she got the chance, I took French A-level, and so came across the works of Albert Camus. Reading L'Étranger, The Outsider, I caught a glimpse of a figure who appeared to be marginal. A female figure who began to haunt me. Camus' hero, Meursault, lives in the same block of flats as a man called Raymond. He agrees to become Raymond's copain, his pal or mate, and then to help him deal with his girlfriend, whom Raymond suspects of being unfaithful. This young woman has no name. Unlike Meursault's other acquaintances, she is simply an Arab girl. Since Raymond gives her money, he considers he possesses her. He tells Meursault that on this occasion he's beaten her until she bled. Before that, he hadn't used to beat her. I used to hit her, but sort of affectionately. She'd yell a bit. I'd close the shutters, and it had finished the way it always does. But this time, I don't think I've punished her enough. Meursault agrees to help, to write a letter purporting to come from Raymond, which would really hurt and at the same time make her sorry. Then when she came back, Raymond would go to bed with her and right at the crucial moment, he'd spit in her face and throw her out. Soon afterwards, the young woman gets beaten up again by Raymond in his apartment. Her cries alert the neighbours who summon the police. Meursault, as Raymond's pal, agrees to act as a witness for Raymond, to say he knows that the girl had cheated on him. At the police station, Meursault testifies accordingly on Raymond's behalf. Meursault says, he got off with a warning. They didn't check my story. Afterwards, the young woman's brother, another nameless Arab, turns up on the beach. And later still, the famous murder takes place. In his afterword, published in 1955, Camus claimed that the hero of the book is condemned because he doesn't play the game. He refuses to lie. Camus is referring to Meursault's unwillingness to act the hypocrite at his mother's funeral, also to express regret for shooting the young Arab man. But in fact, Meursault does lie to the police. Meursault affects moral indifference, but nonetheless makes moral choices. Loyalty to his male mate takes precedence over a beaten woman getting justice. Meursault's lie is not important in the heroic existentialist story. In his afterword, Camus doesn't mention it. I'd written since the age of 5, but now, in the crisis of adolescence, my poems, written in secret, gained an edge of satire and rage. I'd begun to get a glimmer of how speaking my own truth could lead to becoming a subject, rather than a nice, obedient daughter acting out my parents' dreams. But I wasn't yet living in a context where that felt possible. Outward conformity seemed the only option. I was a timid closet rebel. The black polo neck and pack of gitane had to be kept for weekends. By the time I went up to Oxford in 1967, where women were corralled in just five colleges, sexual liberation was in the air, but on male terms. Female undergraduates had the pill, if we could persuade a doctor to prescribe it, and abortion under tight restraints had just been legalised. But class attitudes cut across those potential freedoms. Bullying, public school-induced male attitudes to sex dominated. If you said no, you were a prudish, priggish, ugly swot. If you said yes, you might be pretty, but you were a slag. I searched for theories of resistance, studied the writings of medieval women heretics, wore miniskirts and thick mascara, drank a lot and danced and took drugs, fell in love with men and women both, fended off the sexual harassers and attackers. Nowadays, the predatory men of the 60s and 70s are being hauled up before the courts. People looking back shrug excusingly and say, "Oh, it was the culture." That's too easy. The cultural status quo is shaped by people and can therefore change. Lots of us did fight back and were derided by the press as stupid, shrill man-haters. I was indeed an angry young woman. In mixed company, I often felt either speechless or incoherently enraged. Writing provided a way of stepping back, putting a form on emotions. I kept a diary, went on writing poetry in secret, short stories too, wrote satirical articles for student magazines. Existentialism began to matter again when I encountered the work of Simone de Beauvoir in the early 1970s. Living in a mixed commune in North London, where we all, men and women, shared the housework, I read the first volume of de Beauvoir's autobiography, Memoir d'une jeune fille rangée, Memoir of a Dutiful Daughter, with its passionate elegy for her friend Zaza, who did not manage to escape from her suffocating bourgeois family and ended up dying young. A cautionary tale. De Beauvoir did escape at a less terrible cost. She fell in with Sartre. Angela Carter once remarked, "What did a nice girl like Simone de Beauvoir think she was doing, getting involved with Jean-Paul?" Many women dream of finding a companion who will be their equal, who will understand them, listen to them, talk to them. Sartre promised to do all that, while laying down the rules. Terrified of being trapped, he would never be faithful. They would both have contingent affairs. De Beauvoir, who admired Sartre as her intellectual superior, seems to have assented to life and love on his terms. He understood her wish for freedom and independence, helped her realise them, but nonetheless tried to control her. I was writing short stories now, inspired by a feminist and existential desire to make sense of the world women lived in. I found that the best ones did not attempt social realism, but erupted from my unconscious. I shelved Camus and Sartre and began reading Freud, Melanie Klein, and then Juliet Mitchell's great work, Psychoanalysis and Feminism. I'd begun exploring the theme of the silenced woman, as originally evoked by L'Étranger, her struggle to speak, that's to say, to enter culture. While the heroes of existentialism were lonely, isolated individuals, my female characters needed each other, as sisters, lovers, friends, mothers and daughters, and they fought each other too. Going on to read de Beauvoir's monumental work on women, Le Deuxième Sex, The Second Sex, I was both impressed and disquieted. Impressed because she blew open the assertion of the privileged woman that gender doesn't matter, that she is not oppressed, that she's the exception, that she has never suffered discrimination. Disquieted because while de Beauvoir was investigating how and why women came to occupy the place of the other in men's minds, a lesser, inferior place, she still seemed to accept men's preeminence. They remained the admired norm. I came eventually to see de Beauvoir as brave, investigating the problem from within, from living it herself. She wasn't omniscient, gliding above the problems she described, nor was she a perfected ideal mentor, with her life totally sorted out. She was able to avoid certain struggles. Not living with Sartre, she didn't have to fight with him about who was going to clean the lavatory this week. And living in a hotel, she didn't have to take up her Brillo pads and clean it herself, either. A poorer woman, or man, cleaned it for her. Ho-hum. Her famous key concept was, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. So you could tell and write stories about that complicated process. Indeed, she used fiction to exemplify her arguments, in ways that nowadays seem problematic. We don't see fiction as representational in a straightforward way. Language, describing the real, also creates it. Nonetheless, she pointed me towards writers I'd never heard of, such as the Belgian novelist, Madeleine Bordeaux. Bordeaux's slender output, a collection of short stories and two novels, La Femme de Gilles and Marie, was stopped by the war and the occupation, since she refused to work under her collaborationist publisher. Relevant to the arguments of Le Deuxième Sexe was her description, in Marie, of her heroine's capacity to cope with the repetitive drudgery of housework by transforming it perceptually into a delight in materiality. When she comes up from the cellar, she enjoys the weight of the full coal buckets, even though they seem heavier with every step. She has always felt affection for simple things that have their own particular smell, their own particular roughness, and she's always known how to handle them. Her hands plunge into dead fires or into soapy water. They rub the rust off a piece of metal and grease it, spread polish, and after a meal, sweep the scraps from a table in one great circular movement. It's a perfect harmony, a mutual understanding between the palms of her hands and the objects they touch. Unlike Simone de Beauvoir, Madeleine Bordeaux affirmed the pleasures afforded by certain traditional feminine activities. She affirmed female creativity, sensuality, and physical joy. Her character Marie goes freely and fearlessly about her world, taking a lover despite being married, talking easily to soldiers on a crowded night train, making her own daily decisions whether to do housework or not. She reminds me of Colette's mother, Sido, who was not a sedulous housewife, but always persevered loyally until the job was finished. Then off she would go down the two steps that led into the garden, and at once her resentment and her nervous exasperation subsided. Out in the garden is where I want to be too, sitting with Deborah Levy, not a Brillo pad in sight, talking together, listening to each other's stories, and laughing.